I think we're live, but I don't know yet. And I don't trust technology. I'm afraid we're going to talk for like an hour. And, okay, so on one, I see we're live. No, I don't see, I see we're live. And now I'm going to check on Periscope. Because again, I truly don't trust technology. And I'm afraid that we'll speak for like an hour and then I'll get really upset and it didn't go live and I'll wind up writing like an anti-technology manifesto. We are live. This is exciting. Right. Okay. Okay, we are live. This is so exciting for me. Hi, Tracy.
Hey, how are you?
I'm really, really good. And thank you so much for joining me. This is really exciting for me.
It's very exciting for me as well. We've been chatting for a while, so
I know
we're finally doing this.
I know, and it's funny because you know I've been an investor for 30 years, and about 20 years ago I invested in energy, and I really didn't know what I was doing. And then I realized recently I know so little about energy because I see you tweeting, and you and I have spoken offline, and I see Anas tweeting, and we've spoken offline. And it's really complex. So part of my thesis for my own investment portfolio for 2021 is that the world is being cartelized, right? It's being defragmented. And so I want to invest in those cartels, right? And at the same time, I think this 2021 is when America and Europe learns about geopolitics, because fortunately, we have two oceans. We haven't had to figure anything out. We've got it made. I think that starts shifting in 2021, just as the world becomes more volatile. And then I see what's happening with energy, and I felt like I was missing out on it. And I see you tweeting and Anas tweeting about shale and about this one going out of business and that one going out of business. And I see that also things are trading below market. And I'm always bewildered. So I shoot you an email or I shoot you a text or I'll shoot Anas a text and I'll be like, what's going on? So this is such a fantastic opportunity for me to interrogate you in front of everybody. And we can all learn together. And I know everyone's going to have a lot of questions. So I'll make sure we get to everybody's questions. And I see some people. So thank you for joining us, Guy. Thank you, Crazy News Cycle. That's very thoughtful of you for joining us. And I see Chuck here as well. I see the emissary. So thank you, everybody, for joining me. This is very exciting. And I look forward to your comments. And I see Giants win it all. And perhaps that's going to happen. My son's a huge Giants fan. So let's begin. Tracy, would you be kind enough to introduce yourself?
So my name is Tracy Schuchart. I go by Shy Girl on Twitter. I work for a family office as well as manage my own portfolio. And I have a background in international relations and political science.
Okay, that's great. And it would be probably great to pick it up from where we left off yesterday. And I guess I should have taken transcripts because that was so informative for me. Let's kind of begin where we left off yesterday, which was talking about my air conditioner.
Right. So I think basically if we want to start, right, we can kind of start at like an oil 101 quickie. So first we can talk about world consumption. So world consumption is about 100 million barrels a day in some. That was pre-pandemic. It's about 93 million right now, but that just to show you how much oil that the world consumes on a daily basis. That's on a daily basis. We can take three countries like India consumes 5.2 million barrels a day. We've got China at 14 million barrels a day. And the United States is the largest consumer at 19.4 million barrels a day. So you can see that's a lot of oil. If we look at, say, a barrel of gasoline, like, or a barrel of oil, right? So what does a barrel of oil produce, right? Because we were talking about how energy is everything you do. If you turn on your air conditioning, you're using a fossil fuel, most likely. I mean, there are some renewables, but you're mostly using that gas or some kind of oil derivative for that, or if you turn on your heat. So really, let's talk about, like, let's break down what a barrel of oil can produce, right? So a barrel of oil produces gasoline, right, that you use in your car. USLD, so that's used for like heavy equipment, home heating, refrigerating equipment. Then you have kerosene and jet fuel, and that is used to cooking stoves, and obviously flying. Break it down even more, you have hydrocarbon gas liquids, which used to make detergents, natural gas, transportation and buses for natural gas run buses. They're now coming out with LNG vessels as well. Also paints and solvents, and propane and synthetic rubber. Then break it down even more, you have like residual fuels, and that's used for vessels for ships and things like that. And then others, you have oil and asphalt, tires, lipstick, waxes. So you can see how many uses is that's, those are all the products you can get from one barrel of oil. So that's, you know, that's a lot of things that we use every day. So I know that there is a big push for renewables, and those are, you know, we can discuss those a little bit later because they definitely have their place. But my point is that right now, you know, oil's not going away anytime soon because we're using it every day. It's in you know, if you use a plastic plate or a plastic cup, you know, it's all in the oil, the petrochemical family. We can kind of talk about the largest producers a little bit. The largest producers are Saudi Arabia, Russia, and the United States. They all kind of go back and forth a little bit. That's relatively new with the shale revolution. The United States used to be about 8 million barrels per day before shale came along. And then we can kind of talk about different crude grades just really quickly because I get a lot of questions about this as well because, you know, people think oil is oil, right? So, but there's different crude grades which make different things, and that's why different refineries produce different products according to different mixes, and that's why we have these global oil flows where, you know, where people are buying from all over the world to produce whatever products their refinery is specifically tooled to.
Okay, I'm ready to ask questions, it's so interesting. Can you measure an economy, the health of an economy by its oil, by its energy needs? For example, we see India growing, and I know we're going to be discussing about that, South America, and we're going to be discussing Africa a bit, where there's developing countries. Can you kind of measure how quickly they're developing or how much they're falling back by their energy needs?
Oh, absolutely. Because you're looking at how much more are they consuming per day and what kind of products are they consuming? You know, mostly you see, you know, you can see a transition, say, from like coal into more oil products, into more natural gas products, into renewables. It's kind of the cycle there. And you know, where you have more emerging markets use a lot of coal, like say India, for example, and China, for example, where that market is still really big and still really investable. Whereas we're kind of phasing out coal in, you know, the United States, we, you know, use less than 2% at this point. So there is not only a way to judge the health of an economy is how much that you're using and growing, but also kind of what stage in development you're at.
So what are the countries that you're looking at? I mean, and let me go backwards a little bit, because I am very familiar with trade, right? With trade with us, China, with us, with India. And it's something I observe pretty much on a weekly basis where I'm looking at kind of what boats are moving and what product families they are and, you know, how things are moving along. So how much of trade can you observe also just by their energy needs? Because it takes a lot of energy to move product from here to there.
Oh, absolutely. And what happens is that, you know, this is why I was talking about or have been talking about how, you know, there's no real such thing as energy independence, right? You hear a lot about U.S. energy independence, but really it's all export and import flows. So technically you can say, yes, we're a net exporter, so we're energy independent, but that's, you know, that's kind of a misnomer because global energy flows are, I mean, there's oil and product, you know, moving around the globe all the time. We send product, say, to Brazil that you know, refines it and turns it into another product, and they ship it off to China, for example. So there's a very intricate flow of product and oil. So we're all interconnected. All the oil producing nations and consuming nations are all very interconnected that way.
So when I see that we're kind of a net exporter, what does that mean exactly?
So
you make it sound like a lot of, and I know you and Anas have walked me through it, that there's both a lot of complexity to it.
Right.
And at the same time, that's a war in itself. And we're seeing a little bit of that war being fought out with OPEC and Saudi Arabia and Russia.
Right. Well, we actually have fallen back to, we're now a net importer. because the U.S. is really on the cusp, and that's been over the last year, where we'll have some months we are, some months we aren't. And all that means is that you're exporting more than you're importing from other countries. It's really simple as far as that's concerned. And that would be crude plus product.
And is that a good thing? Because I know I've seen kind of some debates about whether that's the optimal position for the U.S. to be.
I don't think that's necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. I think that because flows are changing all the time, you know, that's kind of still a fluid thing right now. So I wouldn't say it's necessarily a good thing or necessarily a bad thing.
Okay, so I want to be responsive because I asked Guy Mishy. I see Guy Mishy's asking a question, and he's and they say, please explain that, please. But I'm not exactly sure what it is to explain. So if you want to continue with that, if we're producing our own oil, do we need to even be dependent on other countries for their oil?
Okay, that's a better question. Thank you.
Great talk.
Thank you very much. Yes. The thing is that, like I was talking about, refineries are tooled to make different products. Now, the oil that we produce in this country is very, very light. It's WTI, right? It's West Texas Intermediate. It's a very light type of oil. And mostly all that you can get from this is gasoline, is this kind of oil. So if we want to make other products to not be dependent on other people, such as jet fuel, or kerosene, or you know, any of the heavier other oils that we need to use, then we need to import heavier crude to be able to produce those products. So we will always have to import because we just simply don't produce the kind of oil that would make every product that we need to keep this country running.
Okay, I'm going to have a lot of more follow-up questions for you, but I really do want to get I want to change up the scheduling a little bit where I'm responsive and we're responsive to other people's questions, because it's such an interesting thing. And, you know, we all want to know about it because we all want to have a geopolitics sense, and we all want to have kind of the political complexity and then oil and energy. And we all want to know how to invest for the future. Right. So whatever happens with the future, I want to disengage from kind of the, you know, just daily news cycle, and much more be emotionally engaged with how do I wind up on the good side of the trade tomorrow, right?
Right.
So I see a really interesting question here, and it's something that's also come up with Anas. So this is really funny. Let me see if I can post it. Do you see that question in front of you?
Does oil sands imported to Canada then refine it? How does it count? How does it count? Maybe clarify a little bit. So. Well, Canada, I can say, is the U.S.'s biggest buyer, right? So 99% of the oil that Canada produces goes to the United States. Then it is either resold, right? It goes to Cushing, basically. It sits in Cushing, most of it. It is either resold, right, out of the Houston port, or it's refined because it's heavier oil that we need, right? So then it's refined to other products that we need. And those can either be exported or they can be used and or shipped back to Canada.
Okay, so
that's is that kind of what you're asking?
I'm sure they'll follow up, and I see some. I see such interesting questions, and as much as I want to interrogate you, I'm gonna let kind of everybody come in and. So I see this question. If you work in this sector like I do, green energy seems laughable short term. Agree, disagree. But I'm going to change the laughable part because I don't want to include that within the framework because that's such a kind of a tricky type of term to say laughable, and it means a lot of things to a lot of different people. So if I can rephrase that a little bit, Kevin, with your permission, how does green energy affect what you see? In pricing and in consumption and in demand?
Well, I think, I mean, this is also a very geospatial kind of question, right? So if you're looking at a country like the United States, slowly renewables are getting integrated into the system. However, because our, let's take California, for example. They've been having rolling blackouts. So they've tried to incorporate renewables in their system. But the problem is that we have such a mature and aging electrical grid and infrastructure. It's really hard to make that transition, you know, very easily without having severe problems. And that's kind of what we're seeing right now in California. Right. But I don't think that, you know, I think there is definitely room for renewables. I just think it's going to be harder to integrate in some of these countries that have more mature, electrical grid kind of systems. Now, if you look at, that's kind of an exciting area as far as Africa is concerned, because they have what I call kind of like a teenager grid system, right? And their big push, they have a big goal to get 95% of the country, you know, electrified with it by 2025, which is a huge goal.
How much does that cost to be able to?
Well, right now they're looking for $29 billion.
That's not a lot of money. So is that
that's not a ton?
Is that for one country, or because that's such
that's a goal they're trying to raise. Obviously, they'll need more, but we're seeing in Africa is a big push for renewables. Right, because they're very cost effective right now. There's a lot of corruption in some of these oil producing nations, and they're smaller oil producing nations like Gabon, Nigeria, Angola. So there is a big push, and you're seeing a lot of European interest in the utility sector there. As well, you know, they also are, you know, have a lot of rare earth metals. So really, you know, it's an ideal market for them. They don't have to depend on China. So it's a kind of an exciting area, I think, in the renewable industry looking at Africa.
Okay, so somebody asked the Dean95, and thank you for joining us so much, asked how electrified are they now? And I think that's, you know, because we're talking about Africa, I'm going to assume that's a reference to Africa. So how electrified do you feel that they are now?
So, I think it's around, 35 or 43%.
That's really good. That's impressive.
I mean, there's been a lot. There are a lot of projects going on that have started, in 2017, some very mega projects. So, they've come a long way in the last couple of years.
And how much of that is from China, Chinese Exim Bank, or AIIB, which is all trade bank? How much of that is coming as a Chinese investment, which is opaque? And as we discussed in the last one, one of the difficulties with China is that their loans are opaque, so we don't know what the terms are, and we don't know how they've collateralized it, which is, I know, is a concern for my friends in Nigeria and my friends elsewhere. They don't know if their ports or what assets are vulnerable.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's kind of really hard to tell. I mean, there's no real hard data on it because everything they do is pretty opaque, right?
Okay, now I'm going to, everything they do is opaque. So how much competition do we have for investment into Africa?
Well, I think that, there are lots of, I think you know, the United States itself should get in there. you know, because like I said, you know, you've got Italy, you've got a lot of investments especially from Germany and France, even the UK is getting really involved. So, you know, I think that's all the better because, you know, RBI has some problems. And, you know, after a few years now, we're kind of, you know, African nations are kind of discovering that, you know, that wasn't the holy grail for them.
Okay, so we're going to do what do they call it, like rapid fire type of things? Because there's so many interesting questions, and I have my own interesting questions, but other people's questions are kind of more interesting than mine. So I'm going to put this on our screen. I think this is one. How much of solar capacity being installed today is replacement capacity rather than new capacity?
I honestly have to tell you that solar is, that's not really my specialty. So I would have to look that up for you. to be honest, you know, I'm mostly oil and gas. So, you know, renewables are something that, you know, I know about, but it's definitely not my area of expertise.
Okay. And thank you for that. Do we need $55 a barrel for crude? Do we see $55 a barrel for crude anytime soon? I know we were discussing this yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was asking you what I should invest in.
I do foresee, I think that's, yes, I do. Yes, I think out in 2021, you know, perhaps, you know, mid to, you know, maybe Q3, Q4, and then into 2022, that we do begin to see higher oil prices because, you know, hopefully, right, things get back to normal and we start seeing, you know, aviation pick up and things like that. And then because of all the CapEx cuts, because of all the shut-ins that probably will never come back, you know, globally, you know, I think that the supply problem is going to turn to, you know, a deficit instead of an oversupply problem. So I definitely think we will see higher oil prices, but may not be into the back half of next year into, you know, 2022.
Okay. And I'm going to stop the questions for just 1 minute because I do have a good question, right? And I know we were discussing this yesterday, so it would be helpful for everybody else as well because I got like inside. But what are the signals that we should be looking for that energy prices have turned around? And when they do turn around, what are the companies we should be looking at that are doing the mergers and acquisitions and that you feel are best positioned to kind of capitalize on that turnaround? They've learned to run more efficiently. They're operating more efficiently. They've got better assets to exploit and everything else.
Right. So if we're looking at the United States, you know, I personally, I like Devon Energy, maybe something to put on your watch list, DVN. I also like Parsley Energy, which I know some people will disagree, but it's a company that I really like. And they also, I'm thinking too fast. PE is their ticker symbol. What else?
I'm not recommending any of them. What I've asked, just to remind everybody and to clarify, is what are the companies we should kind of be keeping on our, you know, our crotons or our tickers, so that right. We can kind of see, as you know, we can see the signals, whether the signals are happening this month or next year, just so we can be aware of them rather than just kind of observing, you know, the FANG stocks and the other ones. I'm very interested in it because I think developing countries, and I've tried to express this as often as I can and reiterate it, I think, you know, the America right now, our innovation is in very highly complex, and going forward, our American innovation is in very highly complex, high-hanging fruit, big team, very expensive innovation, while as in countries within Africa, and I know you're going to speak with South America, where I'm not as familiar, but in countries within Africa and countries and within India, there is a lot of opportunity for innovation to be downstream there, right? Because they've got the talent, they've got the labor pool, they've got the natural assets, you know, that are needed, and they've got the supply chain density to be able to import and export things as they need them. So can you help me better understand both what those signals are? Again, the companies, and are they going to be the companies that are making inroads into those markets?
So, I mean, those two happen to be very domestic companies, but I mean, there are some other countries are companies that are making inroads in, these are kind of two different subjects.
I know.
Right? I don't know which direction to go first. So, well, first, let's say, what was the initial question, I believe, was, you know, how do we know when, oil is stable? You know, once we see, and oil has been stable for the last 2.5 months, basically hasn't moved. So this is kind of, this is a good sign. This is a good sign for the health of the industry because, you know, we've been able to maintain steady prices. Right. So you'll kind of know, you know, once we start hitting like $50 a barrel and not as a spike, you want to see consistent, right? Like you want to see oil prices consistent for 4 to 6 months before, you know, you consider that a thrivable place to be, right? So, you know, if we start getting into $50, $60 oil, then companies are going to, they're going to start making a lot of money again. and so that's kind of what I would look for. If we're looking for, what are we looking for? We're looking for sustained higher oil prices.
And then in those developing countries, for example, in South America, in Africa, and India, and I, you know, for full disclosure, as many people know, I have 3 startup companies in India, and I also do live there part-time. And I do see a lot of interesting things happening where they're just capturing a lot of innovation. They've got Make in Japan. And at the same time, they have a lot of military adventures, good or bad, military adventures. And that requires a lot of oil and a lot of new energy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That requires a lot of power with, you know, new armies, new navies, and things of that nature is very energy intensive. You know, even, you know, I was talking about, the, even if you were, you know, all these new EV batteries and things like that, I mean, all the batteries that we use, right, are all mining, right, which are very, very energy intensive products as well. You can't, you know, mine for cobalt, nickel, copper, gold, silver, which, whatever, name a metal, without a lot of energy to be able to mine that product. So no matter what, even if you're mining for, you know, renewable sources for, say, metals for a battery to increase, you know, EVs, you're still using energy, right? So, you know, you're still using fossil fuels for that.
So I want to get to Crypto Medici's, and thank you so much. It was very thoughtful for you to join us. So Germany, we're overdue for a coffee, so hopefully soon. Germany dismantling nuclear energy. Why making themselves more connected to oil? What's the strategy for Germany?
Are you talking about Nord Stream 2 or?
Let's discuss first from Nord Stream 2. If you can explain what Nord Stream 2 is, because I know there's a lot of headlines about that.
Right.
And then also let's include kind of their strategy of still having the Russian dependence on Russian oil. And what that means for renewables and kind of the whole thing. So there's 2 questions.
Okay. So, well, Nord Stream 2 is just a gas pipeline, basically from Russia to Germany, right? The United States is against it. And Russia says, I don't care. And Germany says, I don't care. So that's kind of really, you know, this project has been in the works for a very long time. And it's just subject to some geopolitical tensions, let's put it that way, but it's getting built. So that's kind of that with Nord Stream 2. And, you know, natural gas is not, you know, it's a much better source than, say, like a heavier fuel and things like that. I mean, that's why you see LNG buses and things like that, that they're much cleaner burning as far as that's concerned. So, you know, I think that I know that they have a big green push right now. So actually using more natural gas is actually kind of congruent with that sort of theme. But then again, that's all why we're also seeing them heavily vested in Africa right now, right? Because they don't really have the rare earth. They have to depend on China. And with Africa, they can invest in the country, and they can also get the materials that they need for their green push.
So, and I know we were discussing this yesterday, and it was really interesting to me. moving past the outcome of the next election, how much does that actually change the energy scenario? So for example, you were telling me about kind of the Green New Deal, and you reminded me not to think of it as a Green New Deal because, you know, there's some rhetoric in that.
Right.
So, you know, what happens under that scenario? And then what happens if the current strategy just continues going forward? At some point, do they become the same thing, or like what happens going forward?
Yes. I think that, you know, energy companies are sort of preparing themselves for, you know, if we have some sort of policy change within the United States. Right. You know, they're already getting their permits, because what would happen in that scenario is the government would ban fracking on federal lands. That's really the only jurisdiction that they have over. So companies right now are already kind of securing their permits and looking at extending their leases in preparation in case, you know, in the near future, that policy should change. But really, I don't really see that push really coming to fruition, to be honest.
Okay.
Not in the severe form. It's like anything else in politics, right? I mean, there's a lot of things that are presented, and by the time that it becomes legislation, it's kind of all watered down.
Yeah, very interesting. And at some point, does current strategy intersect with so if we project one scenario, which is kind of what calls itself the Green New Deal, and whatever that substantively becomes, right, is a different conversation. But so does the current strategy already start intersecting with that? And I'm calling it Green New Deal because I guess I need a better phrase for it. But
it would be a policy change to a push towards more renewables rather than fossil fuels. But again, yeah. I think that any kind of legislation that we go through would be so watered down by that point, because really, I mean, there's so many jobs and so much money that come in from the industry and dependent on the industry that I just don't see that going away anytime in the near future.
So when you see the California rolling blackouts, is that an indication to you of the unviability right now of real reliance? Is that kind of the proof?
Yeah, I mean, the proof is in that it's mismanaged. You know, like I said, it's very hard to integrate a very new technology with a very aging, mature technology and make that a fluid transition. And so California, that has the biggest push towards that, is kind of showing us that and showing us where the weaknesses are in kind of their plan. So kind of the guinea pig, so to speak. But, you know, it isn't as easy as people think that it's going to be, and it's going to take a lot longer than people anticipate it to be.
Okay, so I still have so many more questions for you. But I want to be respectful of other people's questions, and they might be better than my questions, honestly. So, and thank you very much for coming, Avijay. So, India's NEP40, which is, you know, their own plans, is right now very heavy on coal, as you know. And I think they've indicated yesterday, in the last 2 days, they've indicated that they're going to really make a push towards nuclear energy, and hopefully everybody saw that, because that also requires them to build the infrastructure.
Right.
For nuclear energy. So the question is right now, how much of its energy demand impacts the current price of crude and will impact it going forward?
If in a heavier coal industry, I mean, it won't. You know, as far as India is concerned, I mean, they're still consuming 5.2 million barrels a day. I don't foresee that changing. In addition, you have Reliance, which is the world's largest refinery there. So India is always going to be a very large producer of, are a large, very large consumer of, or at least importer of crude products.
So here's an interesting question, and I'm going to answer part of it and you answer the other part, because this is also part of my thesis in investing in, you know, defense companies, both here and overseas. And so Boeing does accomplish a lot of things for me, and, you know, for full disclosure, I own the stock, but I'm not trying to promote it to anybody else. I'm just giving people kind of my own thinking. Somebody asked, for the long-term investments in oil, do you calculate future wars and oil infrastructure disruption? So let me answer the first part of that, and then I'm very interested in your the pricing part of it. So I'll answer kind of the wars part of it, and then you answer the pricing part of it, because they're they coexist, right? So I honestly do expect there to be wars, and it's part of my thesis in 2021 that is going to be very volatile, and that America is going to be reminded that there are some really bad countries out there. And I hate to say that, as rephrase it. There's some very hostile regimes out there. So please let me backtrack what I said, and now let me kind of go forward with, there are some very hostile regimes out there. And I think, thankfully America hasn't been aware of them, but the world really is, as we discussed last week, getting bifurcated, right? Everybody's figuring out their allies, alliances are shifting, supply chains are shifting. And as you've been discussing, kind of energy is a big part of that. So my going forward thesis is there's gonna be wars. I think China is not building the capacity for its Navy just for show and just to scare people. They've been very belligerent within India. They've been very belligerent with the Doklam standoff recently. They've been very belligerent with how they treat water treaties. They don't have a water treaty with India, so that affects kind of some flooding there. And at the same time, they've made it very clear that their plans for 2050 are to be the leader within its entire complete military presence. And it's not like you just assemble the pieces. You put the pieces on the chessboard, and you're not a master once you've assembled the pieces on the chessboard. You become a master when you practice chess. And China is very intent on practicing chess. So I think the first they'll start out with some more vulnerable countries that will be very big vanity wins for them and their people. China's belligerence, and I'm speaking of the regime, the Chinese Communist Party. So I want to make sure that that's understood. I'm speaking of the regime. So their regime is trying to unify the people as much as they can. It's part of their social credit system. It's kind of part of their operating theory right now. It's part of the four consciousnesses of Z, and it's part of a lot of what they're doing. So part of that will be kind of winning a war, right? And who is going to be likely? I think personally, it's going to express itself with Vietnam. That's my own feeling. It would be a kind of a vanity win for them. America does not have a robust security alliance such as we have with other countries. So I don't see under Trump or under Biden or under any Congress administration us changing that security, the security pacts and what's already there, because it would also interfere with Quad, and it would also interfere with a whole bunch of other things that we're doing, and we have to keep our partners close. So I do expect there to be a war, and that does impact my own investment thesis, both with Space Force, which is going to be a big part of, as you've talked about, mining. And in order to launch these things, we need to have propulsion, and we need to have a whole bunch of other things that require some real serious mining. I'm on Greenland, right? I've said that before. I really want Greenland. I want to
work. I know.
I want Greenland, and then I want
Greenland.
What's that?
You can't just take Greenland.
Yeah, we can. No, we can. You see this? Serious. We can. We should. We take everybody else. Let's take something and then rip up the land, right? There's not a lot of people there. They'll probably cheer us on, right? I do think we're going to have wars, and a lot of them are as the world becomes bifurcated and everybody knows we need to go to space, and that's where wars are going to be fought in the future going forward 30, 40 years. So that's part of my thesis within investing within certain sectors. I also think the world is being cartelized. We're seeing a defragmenting of the world. So those biggest companies are going to just gobble up all their smaller competitors, or they're going to wait them out and win by attrition and let them get starved out. And that will also create a lot of international friction, which is, I think, we're going to see just a lot of international friction as a lot of these companies, indigenous assets get lost. I mean, I've talked about Germany and I've talked about Europe a lot. They're pretty vulnerable right now. Can you discuss the pricing and how such a scenario might impact pricing?
I mean, obviously, it depends on which location that we're talking about, right? If something happens, say, in the Middle East, that's going to majorly impact the price of oil, not only you know, it could be because of a supply issue, but, you know, as for a psychological issue, you know, every time you hear something going on in the Middle East, you see an oil price spike, right? So I think that will depend on, you know, where it is. But then again, you know, and this sounds really terrible, but wars are good for oil. Wars are expensive and they're very labor intensive and they're very energy intensive. So unfortunately, that's actually, you know, sadly, but it, you know, it's kind of a plus on the oil side. And that does sound terrible. I don't want there to be any wars, but really it's a positive.
Yeah, well, listen, I understand it. I mean, reality is reality. And I think everybody needs to be on the right side of whatever the future trades present themselves. We all need to be on the right side of it, right?
Right.
So, you know, that's just the reality of the whole thing. Do you anticipate any real friction occurring within the Middle East? Because I know that right now there is some interesting developments.
Right now you have to, you know, there's always something going on right now, but, you know, really, you know, Libya's hopefully, they just called a ceasefire for the 7th or 8th time. But that's kind of, you know, settling down a little bit. Yemen's settling down a little bit, but I think that, you know, this whole Israel, UAE, kind of thing could present itself a problem with other neighboring nations, as well as, you know, frictions with Turkey and, you know, them trying to drill in the East Med, where you have now Egypt involved and things like that. So I think those are kind of the areas that you kind of need to pay attention to right now at this point. I mean, I don't see anything, you know, in the immediate term in danger, but I definitely can see that working out to not the best outcome.
So when you do your own internal projections and you look at your own investments now within family office, how much do you have to anticipate that type of volatility in the market next year and the year after?
Oh, absolutely. It's always a factor. I mean, when you're investing in kind of any kind of oil company or whatever, especially if it's, you know, overseas, depending on where their assets are. I mean, it's always a factor. That's always something you have to, you know, it's got to kind of be built into your portfolio model. I mean, it's because it is always a risk.
And so do you look at particular types of oil, or do you look at particular markets, or are you looking at regions, or how do you kind of divvy it up within your own analysis?
I'm more of a regional kind of player, you know, like I'm looking at regions, like what's the next new hot region that's, you know, that's investable. So say if we're looking at a country or the continent like South America, right? You know, you have the regular big players that you've always had, Venezuela. Well, Venezuela isn't anymore, but, you know, Argentina, Brazil, you had Guyana, which, you know, was really hot over the last decade or so. But now Suriname, which is Guyana's neighbor.
What country was that?
Suriname.
Okay.
It's literally Guyana's neighbor. Apache Oil just found oil there, just struck oil in January of this year. So, you know, that's kind of a new hot place in South America. And then when I look at continents like Africa, really right now, and then a lot of investors are not looking at is Namibia, which is a little bit south of Nigeria, on the West Coast. So right now you have big players like Total is there, Exxon's there, Eco Atlantic, which EOG is the ticker I like, because these are smaller cap companies, and Reconnaissance Energy, which is ticker is RECO, R-E-C-O. So I'm kind of looking at those companies. Tullow is also there, which is a kind of a mid-sized company. So those are kind of there's nothing that's been discovered yet, but, you know, I'm looking there because they are serving for oil. There's a lot of possibility there. Not a lot of investors are talking about it yet. And so, you know, I'm keeping close track on those companies because, you know, if, you know, they do make a discovery there, then that's, you know, the next, you know, that would be a company I would be interested in investing in.
So when those countries become hot, when they do find oil or however you kind of measure these things, does that also mean that there's now an influx of smart capital, both smart money and, you know, the smart kids? I deal with a lot. I know a lot of kids from Nigeria. I know a lot of kids from a lot of different places. And the world's cranking out some really smart agriculture, mineral mining kids, PhDs in economics. But then one of the problems is they don't really have enough supply indigenously to keep them all employed, you know, with so when there's kind of a discovery and there's a boom, does that boom also kind of cascade down to local economies and to kind of
absolutely of course it does, because you know all of a sudden you have you know, because you have all these people working within that industry, you know, it's kind of just like in the United States, you have all these people working in that industry. That means that, you know, you need restaurants, you need housing, you need.
But those are kind of very momentary type of things. Like Texas goes through a lot of, those small towns go through a lot of boom bust. In Louisiana, they'll have very quick boom bust. There's not a lot of durability to it. So within those countries that you've discussed, is there a durability to it? Do they sustain that?
Yeah, I mean, I believe so until kind of corruption takes over and then you have mismanagement and there you go, which is kind of what, you know, which is, you know, Angola was kind of the darling for a while. And right. And now they're starting that the industry is starting to suffer because of, you know, mismanagement and corruption and things like that. So that, you know, that's also something that you have to consider when you're considering investing in oil and gas in those countries.
Okay, so here's a two-part question because I want to answer one part of it. And thank you so much for being here, Patricia. And hopefully I said the name correctly. I can speak a lot of languages, but my pronunciation is so horrible. It's really bad. Because I have a little bit of a lisp, but that always interferes with the proper kind of articulation of these things. So hopefully I said your name right. Thank you so much for being here. So they asked what, and I'll answer the first part, and I'm asking you to answer the second part. What's going to happen to the oil industry in Venezuela? I'll answer one part of that if that's
okay,
all right.
You go.
So the first part of that was about a few years ago when they tried to introduce their digital currency, right? They tried to introduce kind of their crypto, the petro. And that was really, and there's somebody who's really familiar with, you know, what was going on. And I'll discuss that in just a moment. That was really the elites laundering out their money, because at the same time, there was no market for the oil, right? You couldn't just go out into the open market and sell it. There was no market for it. And so the only place you could kind of, you know, cash on your currency was through their own central bank. And they kind of regulated that also. So it didn't quite accomplish what it was intended to. And then as a residual of that, what happened is a lot of the local gangs, and this was a real problem, took over the towns, they took over the utilities. And they just started, because every country in the world has to subsidize energy for their, you know, for their citizens and residents, right? You got to discount it. So they were grabbing all the cheap energy. And then there were rolling blackouts, just as, you know, there have been in California. And as they took over small towns and they held them hostage and they kept on kind of converting that electricity into Bitcoin. I mentioned this because my friends were from the NSA were the ones who did the money laundering nodes. And after they were finished kind of tracking down, and I know Iran was doing the same thing, and they were, you know, using their own religious institutions, perhaps improperly, I'm sure we can all say that. Once they shut it down, I know that they then did build up a tremendous amount of internal capacity for energy, so they wouldn't have to go through that again. I just wanted to give that anecdote because I thought it was very interesting about how the elites were laundering out their money and how the petro failed. Can you answer the actual question?
Well, what's going to happen? I mean, right now, Venezuela is sadly a, you know, failed oil state. You know, they have some of the largest reserves in the world. And, you know, from, you know, Chavez on, through Maduro, really, you know, the country's just been pillaged, right, by the elites. So really, you're going to, you know, have to see some sort of regime change. I mean, my heart goes out to Venezuela. I, you know, wish the best for them. It's so sad to see a country so rich in resources have it all plundered away by mismanagement, corruption, you know, lack of infrastructure and sanctions. You know, it's heartbreaking to see, really. So, you know, I the only thing that I can foresee for Venezuela is, you know, hope for some kind of regime change, and then, you know, hopefully see a lot of foreign investment into that country to help pick them back up again.
So here's a follow-up question to that, and I think, as I've shared with a lot of people, and I wrote about it both internally within my own office, and then I tried to distill it as much as I could on Twitter. You know, I was recently in Bolivia, and I saw kind of the extraction economy there, and the real transformation in a bad way, actually. You know, first their assets were socialized, and then they were all converted over to corruption, to Chinese property, and affected their trade. It affected their textile industries. It affected their citizenship, as there was a lot of different things that were happening, and affected their social services tremendously. But there was somewhat of a coup, and we did see kind of a rollover. And I'll let kind of the fates decide whether that was a good thing. Although I think Evo does have some, you know, issues. But the interesting thing is, in Venezuela, do you have any opinion on the legitimacy of a new regime coming in? Because it does seem to me that they're asking for American intervention. And should there be American intervention, then what happens next?
I mean, we kind of have with Guaido, right? So we kind of have backed the new regime that's not, you know, that's kind of not real regime, you know what I mean? Like, we, you know, the rest of the world's back Guaido. So, you know, there is another regime, but I mean, you need Maduro out one way or another. I mean, you need him to either give up power or not be here anymore.
And how does that change kind of the world's energy? When you look at it and you do your own analysis, and you obviously have that as some dynamic, right? How does that affect your own kind of projections? If this happens, if this, then that.
As far as Venezuela is concerned?
Or? Yeah, as far as Venezuela really re-entering kind of the world markets.
Really, you're going to have to see literally Maduro give up power and leave, as well as his military, unless they, you know, unless they change sides. But that's really the only solution I see. There is no... He's not changing. There's nothing, you know, nothing's getting better in that country. He already knows it. He's already sneaking gold out, right? He's already sneaking gold to the Iranians. You know, I think he knows that, you know, there's not much money he has left to pay off everybody to protect him.
So in your own projections, does that impact your own price projections for a barrel of oil? Do you see it? Does that make a difference?
No, because as far as that's concerned, trying to bring Venezuela back up to where they once were, it's going to take a very long time.
Oh, interesting. Really interesting. Thank you for that. So Stalker67, and thank you so much for joining us, asked a question I never would have thought of. So I really appreciate everybody here with us. Do you see any consequences, conclusion to pipeline exploration drama in Aegean, in Turkey, and in North Africa?
Well, I mean, you know, as far as, you know, what we're talking about, the Mediterranean, that's kind of the hot spot area that you kind of want to keep an eye on. Because, you know, even though Turkey found some natural gas in the Black Sea, right? You know, it really wasn't a lot, and it really didn't deter them from East Med. So, and again, you know, we talked kind of a little bit about, you know, Egypt is kind of involved now and things like that. So the consequences I see are, you know, there is a risk of, you know, some sort of war happening in that area at worst case scenario. Best case scenario, it's diplomatically resolved, but you know, it's a tense spot right now.
So, and as you know, continuing from the conversation last week with Valina, where everyone was kind of choosing sides now, which is something they haven't had to do for, you know, 50 or 60 years. Are those American allies or are they China allies, or how do you see that kind of being split up?
As far as that area is concerned, I think that area is more, and it's going to be the Western allies, not necessarily just the U.S., but, you know, you've got kind of like the European, the Anglosphere and the Europeans, right? You can kind of lump that together. And then on the other side, you kind of have Russia and China, but China's not involved as much to that extent, and kind of that they really don't care about that area too much. So it's really more of a Russian connection.
That's interesting because now that I think about it, you know, there's six Belt and Road corridors, right? There's to Europe, there's to Africa. And you're right. I'm glad you said that because there isn't a corridor that goes that way. They really don't have much of a desire right now to build into that.
Right.
They do want Greenland though, right? Because they want to shave off the maritime routes.
Right.
McCad guy, and thank you so much for being here. How will the VAT, and I'll answer one part of it, right? And how will the VAT tax impact oil and gas consumption and crude pricing in the U.S. if passed? It's an interesting question because in Europe, and Americans don't really hear too much about the taxing regime and the hostile taxing regime that our friends in Europe are experiencing. But there, they have very heavy taxes, Pigovian type of taxes. Pigovian taxes and also cruel taxes imposed upon oil and gas. So do you see that if that were to happen here, how much would that actually impact pricing?
If we had a VAT tax in the United States?
That hit oil and gas. So it would be kind of another variable within a VAT GST type of tax.
I don't think that it's actually very feasible to have a VAT tax. First, most of those countries that have big VAT taxes also have subsidized oil, right? Or subsidized gasoline and diesel or whatnot. So we have no subsidies in the United States, and each individual state is has their own tax regime as far as, you know, that's why you see different prices all over the country, because every state has to varying degrees, whatever their state tax is. So VAT tax is because of just how the United States is structured, where it's one country, but we have, 50 different governments within that one country. So it's a little bit different. I just don't see how you would have a VAT tax actually come to fruition.
You're saying, because, I expect there to be a VAT tax, and that kind of, there's
really?
Lots of, Yeah. There's going to be a VAT tax here. There definitely is. However, what you've argued is that it necessarily doesn't require kind of a federal rollout, that states can just be belligerent to their own kind of electorate and roll it out independently. And I think that has been in California without any doubt.
Yeah, look at California. Absolutely. They have the worst taxes in the country as far as gasoline is concerned.
Yeah, and it is very Pigovian. I mean, they're definitely able to flip a switch on anything that they want very, very quickly. So that would really be, how they, the instrumentation of it.
Right.
Okay. So my answer then would be there's going to be a VAT tax, and that's kind of rolled out, nationally. However, it's coordinated through a federal approach, or whether it's done through, state sovereignties, is certainly up, for negotiation. Whatever state it's going to be, I'm moving to another state. That's just me. So from Europe, where it is subsidized, do you see that demand has increased or demand has dropped over the last few years? What are you looking at?
In Europe, gasoline is, it's very expensive compared to, say, the United States, right? Even compared to Canada. And there you do see, there's still a lot of drivers, but, you do see more, they're bigger in public transportation and things like that. But they have a lot more available, right? They have high-speed trains. They have, things that we don't have, that kind of infrastructure in the United States. you know, as far as for travel, whereas Europe does, it's very cheap. You can take a train anywhere in Europe. It's fast and it's really inexpensive. So you don't always need a car there.
Okay, so here's a very interesting question. I'm going to answer half of it. And so thank you very much for asking. Then you answer the other half, which is best investments in case of a limited war. Well, I've discussed it offline and online as much as I can. The world is really being defragmented right now. So if we know that the world is being cartelized, we buy the cartels, right? So part of those cartels are clearly, as you've stated, going to be in, you know, the big oil and gas companies and the companies that can afford to kind of attrit the other companies out, and they can be squeezed out in this market where they're definitely vulnerable, where the smaller companies are definitely vulnerable. We've seen a lot of bankruptcy, so you'll see a lot of reorganizations, I guess. But so right now, and I've been, you know, very bullish on Tesla, and I've been very bullish on a lot of the FANG, because the world is being cartelized. And if the world's going to be defragmented, we want to buy buy those companies that are doing that. We want to buy the cartels. So best investment in case of a limited war. This is why we have to look. So the person asked, best investment in case of a limited war. And that's where we really have to start now looking at overseas markets as investors. Because a lot of the companies where we're going to see real booms, and Tracy, if you can answer in terms of energy in just a moment, but there's a lot of really interesting things happening in the Indian markets. And I'll be discussing that next week with both their startup environment, where they're really building up a startup ecosystem. The American ecosystem has been so successful that now for the first time, we're beginning to see that being exported out and being synthesized into other countries, which is really just remarkable to see. So in the United States, we don't have a lot of smaller tertiary type of players in the defense industry. I've been down this road with Boeing before, actually with McDonnell Douglas, case in point, which also had a problem with a plane coming down and also had a problem with a short recession that occurred. And, I look at these things as kind of indigestion. You know, these are big boy companies, and McDonnell Douglas wound up being one of the real big winners. And then they were acquired by Boeing. It's a very interesting, these are very interesting industries, because Google, Amazon, they really are doing a lot of innovation. It just is not apparent, but Google has leased a lot of supercomputer time, and there's a real scarcity of that. They've got it from NASA, where you're seeing a lot of, for example, innovations that you'll be hearing about soon. I'm part of one in quantum computing and quantum teleportation, which is communication, how all these devices are going to communicate in the sky, friend or foe systems, how they're not, as you saw in Iran, where they gave some guys a truck and some big guns and just said, shoot anything. And they wound up shooting down their own airliner. That's a real, real problem, as the skies are very congested in open markets. So in order to resolve that, you need much better friend or foe systems, especially when the object's in a cislunar orbit. So that's my answer to the question, which is kind of on the directional side. Tracy, can you be responsive to that?
So, I agree with that. So if we're looking specifically at the energy markets, right, then, you know, I would say, I'm looking at utility developers in Africa, for example, things like that. If there's, you know, if we have limited war, I want to be on the forefront of where kind of the next energy boom is in an area that's not going to be subject to a lot of hostilities.
So we're coming up on an hour now. And thank you. Actually, we're past an hour. It's been an hour and 3 minutes. I want to thank everybody for their time. I'm going to look at one or two more questions. So Tracy, we've got that lightning round thing. I promise I won't slow it down with thunder. I'm very interested in nuclear energy, and I'd like to have a guest on soon. His name is Mark Schneider. Really, really smart guy, and I've had the pleasure of his company. Are you watching nuclear energy, and is that disrupting the markets at all?
Well, I do to some extent. I know that there's a big push for it, say in India and things like that, which is also, you know, it's also clean tech, right? United States kind of shied away from it. Europe's kind of shied away from it a little bit, but you know, I can see some more emerging markets where this could be a big investment.
Okay, so, and then I guess the last question, let me make sure it is the last question. It was about precious metals. The precious metals I'm going to be doing with Luke very soon. And I think we just scheduled it now for 3 weeks. And it's going to be another one of our Wednesday on, you know, investor series. I have an inventory in gold. I'm a strong believer in hard assets. I think it's really, really important. Also, because if you want to have wealth preservation and generational wealth, it's going to be very difficult. So you're going to have to work much harder to be able to pass that money on, right? And in such a way that it's not into a taxable vehicle. And that's real estate and that's gold, because gold has no memory. You can bury it in your backyard. You can't do that with other currencies. So I'm looking forward to the gold ones. I want to make sure I was responsive to that. What percentage metals? That's a very individual question. It really depends on your risk tolerance and on your pain tolerance and also on your patience. So I think there was one other question here I want to make sure. And crypto, I agree with it. Greenland, yeah. Greenland's going to be awesome. Just buy Greenland. Honestly, just buy it. Just buy the place. Either buy it or, you know what I'm saying? Just, you know, just... You know, yeah, yeah. Come on, we're adults here. We know. Maybe they have weapons of mass destruction, right? One never knows. We could. Okay, so I think that's it. And the last question then was by Paulson 3001. So thank you very much for asking the question, and thank you for joining us. Is best preferred method to short China? I'll be discussing that at a different forum. And it's going to be an investor series also, because I've been very involved in that, as a lot of people know, for several years. And I've been fortunate. I've been able to carry those positions. I could kind of wait them out as there were spikes. And I anticipated those spikes with certain trade things and certain other dollar scarcity, dollar denominated debt, which led to this recent trade deal. And the recent trade deal that you saw announced in December, I didn't expect to be anything. So I'm certainly not disappointed in its failures. I knew that essentially it was a way for China to be given an, it was a way for China to be able to deliver on, they had a very large dollar denominated crunch that they needed to deliver on because of their debts. And it was a simpler resolution for the whole world to just help them out with a couple of dollars, and because the consequences otherwise would have been bad there. And remember, a lot of the countries that they were indebted to are American companies that held assets in some of these other companies in China. So Sierra Foothills Gal said physical gold or ETF. I'll have Luke answer that, because he's such a bull and he's done so well within that. Thank you everybody for your time. We went an hour and 7 minutes. Tracy, do you have any questions for me or for everybody else?
No, I just want to thank everybody for giving me your time this afternoon, and thank everybody for their questions, and thank you for being a wonderful host, and thank you again.
And thank you. Thank you, everybody. Have a wonderful day. Thank you for joining us. Bye-bye. And bye.